I'm Nick Harcourt, and welcome to another episode of The Sound of Success, the podcast where we talk with movers, shakers, and just plain cool people about music. I'm joined on this episode by guitarist, singer, and songwriter, and author Thurston Moore, probably best known as a member of the groundbreaking and highly influential band Sonic Youth. Outside of that band, Thurston has a long list of side projects and credits, including work with John Zorn, Richard Hell, Lydia Lunch, Yoko Ono, Dave Grohl, REM, and Beck. He's also made 9 solo albums, the most recent of which, Flow Critical Lucidity, is set for a September 2024 release. In 1981, he founded the Ecstatic Peace record label, which has released more than 200 LPs, cassettes, 7-inches, and CDs of both established and fledgling artists, and his creative palette has included writing and performing music for film, narrating documentaries for the National Geographic Channel, a residency at the Louvre in Paris, and teaching writing at Allen Ginsberg and Ann Waldman's Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Boulder's Naropa University. And he's an honorary professor at the Rhythmic Music Conservatory in Copenhagen, Denmark. Thurston, you and I have spoken before, but not for a while. It's great to reconnect.
Yes, it is. How are you?
Man, it took me so long to put that intro together.
I was well. Who is this guy?
Yeah. Because your creative output is so immense, but it all started with the electric guitar. And I know your dad was a music professor. What was your household like, and what kind of a kid were you?
Well, I was always engaged with music, and I guess it has a lot to do with the fact that my father was a musician. I mean, he was always at the piano. You know, when he was in the house, he was at the piano. And just working through, you know, all the classical repertoire that he was steeped in. And so that music was always there, you know. But at the same time, when I was maybe 8 years old, I was gifted a transistor radio, which was amazing because transistor radios, the handheld transistor radio in the early mid-60s was like the coolest thing you could ever give a kid, you know. It was a very hip thing. You know, I was just amazed to just sort of get this gift. You know, pulling that long antenna up and just finding, like, you know, the local AM station, and there was the Monkees or the Beatles or whatever it was. And so I never really thought that I wanted to be involved with music or be a musician or whatever. It was just always, that was what was always happening. I felt like I was always defined by that. Anyway, it wasn't like I needed to think about, like, I'm going to go to music school. I'm going to become a musician. I'm going to join a band. It was just like, that was always on the horizon, and I was just waiting for senior year in high school to let out so I could run off to New York and join a band, you know.
Yeah, well, your early child was in Florida, teenage years in Connecticut, and then you finished high school, did a semester at college, and then you did run off to New York. Something else was calling, and I believe you moved to Manhattan's Lower East Side, right in the middle of New York's punk, post-punk, and whatever other scenes were going on in 1977. And I read a quote from you where you said it was a completely new world, a new identity of music that was an option for youth culture. Can you expand on that?
Well, the option was that it was this place where you could actually express your creative impulse, you know, as opposed to sort of hanging out with a bunch of jokers, you know, in front of the supermarket, you know, smoking weed and cashing up coin to buy beer and then, like, getting in trouble. You know, I mean, I did a lot of that too as a teenager. That was kind of like, you know, it had its fun and games, but I really wanted to go to where the Ramones were, you know, or, you know, where Patti Smith was, because I was reading rock magazines and seeing what was happening in the city. And the fact that stuff was happening in the city was kind of a new thing culturally, because in some ways it was all about running off to the country when I was growing up and being part of the whole sort of hippie, you know, get away from the dirty city and go to the country and sort of, like, you know, and be like a Grateful Dead kind of musician or whatever. I actually sort of thought about that when I was younger, but then I started images of actual city dwellers like the Ramones and Patti Smith and Blondie, and I was like, oh, that's way cooler. There's something that had an edge to it that really spoke to me. And I said, I knew that's where I wanted to go. So, and it was easy enough living in Western Connecticut to get a train and take the hour and a half train.
Get into the city, yeah.
Get into the city, you know, as soon as you could figure it out in my later teens. I guess I could have started playing music earlier. It was funny because by 80, 81, all of a sudden you had this whole scene of bands that actually were sort of 16, 17-year-olds starting hardcore bands all across the USA. And he didn't need to go to the city. They also had hardcore bands in all their little communities. And that didn't exist in 74, 75 so much. You know, if it did, it was very spurious. But by 81, 82, that was existing big time in the hardcore scene. And I was really envious of that. I mean, I wish I had that when I was 16, 17. I wish I was 16, 17 in 81, 82 so I could have been part of that. But I wasn't. I was always 1 foot in that scene and 1 foot in the older sort of avant-garde art rock scene. And I was kind of pulled between the two. And it always was the case. I felt like slightly out of place with both of those scenes in a way.
It's an interesting time because you and I are about the same age. We're contemporaries. I think we're a year apart. And I've always felt from my perspective as a teenager and becoming a young man that I was trapped in between a couple of things because I didn't fit into the boomers thing. It's like the whole thing, you know, want to run away and be a hippie. But it kind of had happened by the time I was a teenager, young person anyway. And there's a I forget what they call it now, but there is a sort of 7 or 8 year gap in between boomers and Gen X that you and I fit into.
Right.
We don't quite belong in any of those scenes,
yeah.
But you create your own scene at the end of the day, don't you? And when you moved to New York, I know you mentioned some of the bands that you were being exposed to. Spoken Word had a big impact on you as an observer. And how did that activate you as an artist?
I mean, that's, you know, that period of 76, 77, 78, that late 70s period for people who were born in the late 50s, I was born in 58. And so, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it wasn't sort of like all of a sudden punk rock happened. It was very transitional. And it was very transitional from a lot of hippie aesthetic as well. I mean, even though punk came out and said, you know, kill the hippies, it wasn't really, I mean, it was actually like, you know, it was all about sort of wiping out everything before, you know, the defining aspect of punk rock. So you could say just like, you know, destroy everything and like, let's start from the smoldering rubble. But, you know, hippie really defined a lot of what punk was. I mean, Patti Smith came out of like hippie culture, you know, so, you know, it was really sort of had people like Johnny Rotten, you know, referring to her as a hippie, as a barefoot hippie, you know, and people referring to television as like, you know, long-winded hippie guitar solo music or something. You know, but it was so, but at the same time, Patti Smith and television were kind of like completely and utterly significant to sort of what transpired as punk rock. And I, you know, you can really sort of get into talking about this, you know, this kind of relationship between this kind of, you know, sort of this kind of academic and intellectual culture, mixing it up with this kind of street culture. So you sort of talking heads, you know, who are this kind of Rhode Island School design graduate band on the same stage as Johnny Thunders, you know, who's like this kind of Brooklyn ne'er-do-well junkie rocker, you know? So it's this kind of like those two things clashing on that stage were really what really defined the music at that time. It's like Malcolm McLaren being, you know, taking the kids who were stealing stuff from his store. They were going to be the band, you know, who represented the story. It's like these kind of ideas of this kind of clash between the street and the high-minded kind of idea of this kind of artful presentation. That would really fascinated me, mostly in retrospect. But at the time, you know, I wasn't really being so analytical about it. I felt like that that to me was so important because it had so much to do with spoken word and literature. I mean, Patti was a spoken word artist, for God's sakes. You know, her first advertisement for horses was like, she wrote it herself. It was like the power of the spoken word merged with the music or the beat or whatever she said. And, you know, it was very specific. It was like, I'm a poet. I write poetry. You know, poetry is news. You know, poetry is the energy of our culture. And so to be a poet in a rock and roll band is going to be the future. And Dylan was already doing it, but Patty was actually really kind of like making it something entirely contemporary, you know, for us, you know. And that to me was really what I wanted to be part of, because I was writing, I was interested in music. And here was this idea that it was this unified discipline. And so, you know, it was almost like anything and everything was possible. And it continues to this day. I think, you know, it was such an important time to witness and be a part of. And I kind of don't like, in some ways, I don't like grandstanding about it, because it's like, oh, in my day, Sonny, you know, we really had this really incredible time. It's like, you don't have that now. It's like, that's not true at all. It's such a exploded library right now of just like being able to sort of reference just about anything in culture and subculture. I'm really happy to have lived long enough to sort of see this happening, you know?
The availability of everything, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. And being able to sort of parse it. I mean, I never underestimate the intelligence of youth when it comes to sort of dealing with like what they have in front of them, you know? And sure, it's risky, it's dangerous, and it also can sort of, lead to places that are, really psychologically damaging. But then, that's always been in the world anyway, you know? It's like, keeping your kids from going to see movies in the 1940s or something. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's like that there's always going to be, life is always going to be a risky endeavor. So the internet is just what we have right now, but I love it.
Every generation gets its own version of what the previous generation had. And as we sort of work our way through, you know, you and I are old enough at this point to have seen a couple of generations come after us. And personally, I have to say, as a parent of two 21-year-olds, I would not want to be a kid in this generation. It's pretty tough out there.
I guess not. I mean, you certainly can't roll a joint on a download. Let's put it that way. But I don't know. I mean, it's like, I see. You know, I've been working with this really young band right now, and they're all in their early 20s, and they're just like the nicest, kindest, smartest people. So there's some parents are doing really good work out there. I'm sure you are. And I hope I was with my 30-year-old daughter, Coco. Mm. She's really smart and happy. And she, you know, she's in love and, you know, and with a really cool person and all this kind of, you know, she lives in New York City and she writes poetry and does art. And, you know, I couldn't be more impressed by a lot of youth culture. But I understand what you're saying. I personally would really not want to live in a world where it was primarily a digital culture that you're dealing with on a daily basis, as opposed to the vibrational culture of actual, you know, physical touch all the time with, you know, of what the work is. But, you know, I mean, is it better or worse? I don't know. Maybe for you, it's worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's different. As I said, you know, they get their, you know, we all get our own version of what it means to be a teenager, a young person, and obviously moving with our own generation through all the phases of life that we go through if we're lucky enough to stick around. You know, reading up about the early days of Sonic Youth, I read that you described that time as being part of a community of dispossessed people.
I feel like it was a community that called to people who felt like they didn't feel comfortable following in the footsteps of like the expectations of and standards of just conservative lifestyles that had been established, you know, in their families or in their towns or cities or wherever they were living. And you know, it was also this idea of wanting to sort of be an artist, you know, being, you know, whatever your discipline is, whether it's music or visual art or, you know, or dance or whatever. But it's like, you know, that was always sort of poo-pooed and relegated as being secondary, tertiary, you know, vocation, as opposed to being a scientist or being a doctor or being a teacher or being a whatever. And it's like, I think there's this realization when you get older that it's, you know, that it's equal value to, you know, to those professions. But you more ever felt that, that you ever really made to feel that way growing up in the 60s and 70s? It was, that was always kind of like, when are you going to get a real job? I have a relative who would say that to me when I was well into my 30s, you know.
When are you going to get a real job? Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and I was like, you know, I'm actually kind of doing better than you are.
And by the way, redefining how to play guitar as well along the way, making your own contribution. Talking of Sonic Youth, you wrote a book last year. Well, I presume you wrote it in a year or two before, but it was published last year. An autobiography, I guess, essentially, Sonic Life, a memoir. And that covers the career of Sonic Youth, which was a long career, tons of albums, different phases of a career, though, as well, right? Going from those early beginnings in New York to becoming really almost by accident, because you were one of the original sort of alternative bands when that alternative, without the category being sort of put by your name, but when that category did explode in the 90s, it became a mainstream movement, and Sonic Youth were right there.
Yeah, I mean, we were already a little long in the tooth, like when that started happening, and the bands that were really sort of capitalizing on that were at least a half generation younger than us. You know, we were already a bit of what the industry was calling a legacy act. But we were also the band that a lot of the younger bands, whether it, you know, Nirvana and all their friends, were looking at, you know, and talking about, you know, that Sonic Youth was important, Black Flag was important, the Minutemen were important, the Meat Puppets were important. And then before us, it was like, yeah, the Slits were important, the Raincoats were important, the, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we were already in a sort of, we were like second generation legacy. We were like an 80s band. So these bands, that alternative rock explosion that came out of the Nirvana explosion is, you know, it's like 88, 89, and then 90s, totally. But yeah, I think, you know, we were already a little too old. I mean, it was even like with punk rock, it was just like, there was a few pre-76 artists that were accepted, but not many. So the ones that were accepted were people like the ones who actually created templates and blueprints for so much of what punk rock was, such as Iggy Pop, David Bowie, Brian Ferry, Roxy Music, you know, these things. They were allowed at the table, you know, but, you know, it took a long time before Led Zeppelin was cool again, you know. Led Zeppelin was not accepted or cool in 1977 punk rock at all. It was just like, in fact, it was the antithesis to that. It was just like long hair and high, you know, high-pitched vocals and these long, wanky guitar solos. It wasn't until at some point in the, you know, in the 80s, when all of a sudden it was just this rediscovery of like the good bands that existed pre-76, let's let them back into our lives.
Yeah.
Oh, and all of a sudden you started having, you know, alternative rock bands sort of referencing this stuff. You know, I remember hearing when I first heard Dinosaur, who became Dinosaur Jr., and Jay Mascus was like blasting out these like long, you know, wild, amazing lead guitar lines. It was really audacious because no punk or hardcore band was really doing that or could do that, but he could do that. And he was referencing it non-ironically, and cause he could really shred. And so why not? And he did it in the context of this kind of new band of like alternative music, you know, Dinosaur. And it was really fascinating. But I remember taking Viv Albertine, who was one of the women in the Slits, the 70s UK punk band, see Dinosaur Jr. And we stood on the side of the stage by the monitor board, and they were great. And they were killing it. And Jay was just like really just going wild, like playing this like wicked lead. And Viv started yelling in my ear. She goes like, "This is horrible. What is this? I thought we fought against this. This long..." She knew what she was listening to. She was like, "Why are they playing lead guitar solos? Get me out of here." You know? And I was just like, wait. You sort of missed a period where we developed into this again, you know, like she had kind of been absent from the scene for a bit. So I remember being a little shocked by that and thinking like, oh, but it's valid. It's cool. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I've been around long enough to see these things go out of fashion and come back, probably three times. Yeah. I think exactly. at this point. And talking of the 90s, we'll just wrap this part up and then we'll get into the music question there. But, you mentioned, you'd already been around a while. You were an 80s band, but there's no doubt that the 90s were good to you. I mean, the first time I saw you guys was at Lollapalooza, which you headlined, I think, in 1995. You sailed into the 2000s, becoming one of the most influential bands of that era. How do you see the band's legacy today?
Oh, well, I think we had a lot longer existence than most bands do, that's for sure. So in that respect, I don't feel like we cut the cord any time too soon. I think we had a really sort of cogent and healthy lifespan. And I think my last record we did, The Eternal, was a very good last record. And we didn't think of it as a final recording when we were recording it. So, but as it came to pass, it was. And so I feel extremely content with that being the final recording. That said, I don't dwell on it. I really feel taken aback sometimes when just somebody out of the blue will come up to me, on a train or like in a supermarket and tell me how important Sonic Youth was to them at different ages, people my age, people older, people much younger. And that's always it's always surprising. I never feel like that I'm that recognizable as such, but sometimes I am. And then it's sort of I feel a little like I want to disappear a bit. But at the same time, it really touches me, and I feel really honored that we sort of had that effect. It's a bit of an ego stroke, so I try not to sort of like wallow in that stuff, And I just feel like, just continuing to write and compose music and write books. I mean, Sonic Life, I don't think I even mentioned the word Sonic Youth until three quarters of the way through the book. Most of that book is all about development and moving towards this place. And as soon as the band begins, I tell the origin story of it with where we all meet and how we sort of, collaborate and what our principles are. But by the time it reaches the 90s, I kind of blow through, it's the end of the book, and it becomes a little bit like album tour, album tour, album tour. And I've already kind of given you an idea of what that is all about. And to actually sort of talk about each album, there's not enough pages to do that. I feel like I could do a book where I just focus on each of the recordings that Sonic Youth did, but it would have to be very extensive. It couldn't just be pithy. And so Sonic Life is not that book. And to be self-critical, I'm not really that interested in being self-critical. So it would just sort of be like a bit of a travelogue of the recording session.
As we're speaking today, it's the end of July 2024. And obviously these things live for a long time, hopefully forever. So whenever you're listening to this, Thurston's album Flow Critical Lucidity is released on September 20th of this year. And for our listeners who want to go deeper in the early Sonic Youth history, check out the autobiography, Sonic Life, a Memoir. So let's get to our music questionnaire, the questions I ask everybody. It's fascinating for me to see the range of answers I get for these questions. It's kind of like my own version of a Proust questionnaire. What is your first musical memory?
It would be just my father playing piano, for sure. He was playing piano when I was still in utero. So it would, that's what would have been my first musical memory, was that the sound of a like a baby grand. And I just like, it would weird me out when I would go to somebody else's house and there would be no piano when I was younger. It's like, where is it? I thought it was like a car,
Everyone had one. What was the first music you bought with your own money?
It was Inagata De Vita, the album by Iron Butterfly. And I would listen to it incessantly. I wasn't quite sure I liked it, but I certainly liked Inagata De Vita. And I knew I wanted to buy that record because it had a sidelong title song. And that was really, seemed really audacious. And so I was kind of like already just, you know, interested in, you know, things that were a little out of the ordinary, maybe with like rock bands, what they were doing. But that was, I think it was the first time I had any coin in my pocket to buy a record. I bought a couple of 45s before that, like in the year 2525 by Zahir and Evans. I would listen to that incessantly, writing down the lyrics as I could hear them. I probably bought, and also Get Together by the Youngbloods. And I had those two 7-inches I remember buying. And then I bought Inagata De Vita.
Where were you hearing music at this time? We talked a little bit earlier about having a transistor radio, which was obviously the first portable music delivery system. I had one as well. I used to listen to it in bed at night. Where were you hearing this music that then made you want to go out and buy the records?
I have a brother who's 5 years older than I am. And he and his hippie friends would come over and play records. And so I certainly heard records peeling out of his bedroom. And I would hear like the heavier stuff, you know, with your Jefferson Airplane and, you know, Deep Purple, you know, and so there was always rock and roll music, happening, because of having an older brother. Yeah. You know, I think if I didn't have an older brother, I'm not quite sure, because it was just sort of dependent on what you would hear on the AM radio in the car sometimes. My father always had the classical station on. And then I remember having a couple of school friends like reaching over the seat and turning on WABC, which was like the New York, you know, AM station where you could actually hear the hits of the day. And like really just thinking like how incredible that was. Not just the music, but just everything that was going on with the advertisements, with the DJs, and just sort of like the, It just seems sort of this really incredibly like high energy, positive world of just like, you know, good times, you know.
And the beauty of audio without pictures, of course, is that, you know, you can make up your own stories, not just about the music that you're hearing, but about the people who are presenting it as well.
Yeah.
The DJs.
And seeing the rock magazines, you know, in the magazine racks at the supermarket, which is where you would go. That's where I would go, because I would go to this supermarket with my mother as a young little boy, and then there would be music magazines, Rolling Stone and Circus and Hit Parader and Cream. And when I got older, I was like, yeah, Cream magazine, my God. You know, so it's like you saw pictures of these people, and they all looked fantastic, you know, long hair and just, you know, just kind of they were like radical, you know? And so to me, and there was, I just wanted to be that. I wasn't sure if I wanted to be Jimmy Page or Captain Beefheart, for God's sakes. It was just like, wow, there's so much to choose from.
What was the first concert that you went to without any adult supervision?
I never was supervised by going to concerts. My parents never took me to concerts. So it wasn't like, I had seen a concert yet, but the first one I went to without any adults is when I got dropped off at Western Connecticut State College in school, I don't know, early 70s, 70, 71, 72, somewhere around there, to see Sha Na Na. And I really wanted to see Sha Na Na because they were playing and I saw it listed and I was like, I really want to go see Sha Na Na. And they were from New York and there was something really exciting about Sha Na Na at the time. They had just sort of been making a big splash and playing on TV and stuff. And they were like greasers and it was like, you know, high concept and, you know, '50s rock, you know, it was back. And, you know, the whole rediscovery of like Elvis and Eddie Cochran and all that was like kind of really big in the 70s. And even like the glam bands were sort of like, you know, trading off of this, like this kind of 50s thing. Even the Ramones, when they first started, I thought about it as like, oh yeah, the leather jackets and the ripped jeans, and they were kind of doing this, this kind of like high concept '50s greaser thing. But you know, they were the Ramones, and there was always this kind of vibe there. So Shauna and I really ruled the roost as far as that whole thing goes. And they were super fun. So, but it was a disaster because they dropped me off and I was with a friend and we waited and waited with all these college hippie kids. And finally they let us all in and the doors were open, but we had waited so long. It was such a delay, I guess maybe because of sound check, who knows? And I couldn't wait to get in there and see this thing happen. And as the doors opened, it got really late. And all of a sudden my parents had returned to pick us up because the concert was partially over, but it hadn't even started yet. And I was like, no. It hasn't started yet. And my father was like, oh, well, okay, we'll just wait in the car. And I was like, oh man, you know, I was like, okay. And then my friend was like, well, no, I have to go home. You know, my parents are expecting me. I can't stay out. Like,
how old were you?
I was like probably 13 or
right.
And it's just like, and I was just like, this is a disaster. And so we went home and I just sort of sat there in the car thinking like WTF, you know, like I just didn't know how to process it. I had not even seen a concert yet. So like, it was just like, is this, I didn't know what I was missing.
So the first concert you went to, you actually didn't go.
I didn't say. And then the next day in the local paper, there was all this like review of just like how great it was. And there was pictures like, you know, Bonzo like on stage and the waiter was like, and I was just like, oh my God, there it is. I missed it. And I could have been there and I was there, but I didn't see the concert. So my first concert was not Shauna on Up.
What was the first band you saw play live?
The first band I saw play live was I was really little living in Florida and we were at the Miami Orange Bowl parade and a float came by and there were the Supremes singing Baby Love on the float.
Oh, wow.
And I was pretty young. I was like, you know, maybe 7 or 8, but I knew that it was like, I knew who they were from seeing like Ed Sullivan or something. And there was these three women singing Baby Love. And I was like, oh my God, it's the Supremes. So I saw the Supremes.
Amazing.
You know, like in the mid 60s. And that was like, I can picture it like it was yesterday, you know.
What do you listen to when you want to dance?
Sly and the Family Stone, you know, dance to the music. How can you not dance to that?
What do you listen to when you're feeling sad?
Well, there's a song called Ida Lupino by Carlo Belay. You know, it's a jazz piano song, but it's more than that. It's not, he wouldn't really think of it as jazz per se, but I mean, she was a jazz pianist amongst many other things. She was fantastic, but she wrote this beautiful, sad song called Ida Lupino that gets covered by a lot of different people. I know Nels Klein did a really nice version of it. That song to me is like, it's just like perfect sadness.
I met her when I was living up in Woodstock a couple of centuries ago, an amazing artist who just did so much stuff and so much different work as well. If you could only hear one song for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
I think anything would kind of wear thin after a while. I mean, it would have to be instrumental music. So I was thinking about that, but I think maybe like the Janapades, Eric Satie's piano pieces, the three Janapades. I mean, you hear that once in a while and you just know that this like, it's just timeless, like masterpiece of just like really meditational music by this French composer. And it's such a classic earworm. But when I go into some establishment and I hear that like on the system or somewhere, it's just like, I feel like I could listen to it forever. It's just like, it does not ever feel like it's a compositional note play that would ever get weary of. It's so beautiful and smart.
You've made music videos through the year. I don't know how important a part of your creative process music videos were or are, but do you have a favorite music video from somebody else? And if so, why?
Well, I've always actually really liked making videos to some degree. I think it's a really cool art form. I mean, there's so many amazing videos. I mean, certainly a lot of those Beastie Boys videos when they were in their prime were just like really hilarious and fun and just incredible. The one that MCA Adam Yauch was making for the band. But it's this period during 80s hip hop in New York City. There was a video channel called Video Music Box. There's actually a documentary about Video Music Box that you can sort of find somewhere online, but it's a great doc. But Video Music Box was a UHF channel video show that just showed hip hop videos. And it was really, really good. It was really just like a street production from Brooklyn or Queens or whatever it was. It wasn't Manhattan, but we would go to like hip hop parties and just sort of film there. And then they would show all the recent hip hop videos in the 80s. So I watched that religiously. There was one video on that show that stays with me and I just love it. It's It Takes Two to Make You Feel All Right by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. And it's just such a kind of like simple, like budget conscious video that was made in the streets of New York with this New York City, really just super New York City hip hop group, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. And it was one of the ones that was like, you know, the song is such a great hooky song, taking that James Brown riff and just like repeating it over and over again. And it's just them like walking around with all their crew, like through the streets of New York City. And then it would keeps cutting to this young girl dancing, you know, just like really doing this crazy hyper like hip hop like moves. And it's just really joyful, you know, just beautiful video. I love that video. And so whenever I hear that song, I picture it. So yeah, I would choose that one as my favorite music video.
It's interesting with videos because there was a time when people were just sort of making them with cheap equipment, you know, making their own videos when portable video cameras first became something. And I don't mean portable in a handheld. I mean, like you'd have a pack, like a big thing hanging off your shoulder, which actually had the recorder in it. And then a camera attached to it, and people would make early videos with those things. And then with MTV, obviously, and a whole other way to make money for the people who made these things, they were going up to like $1 million budgets on these things before that whole world fell apart. And now we're back with people making video content for like $500 or something. It seems to have been democratized a little bit.
Yeah, I mean the most significant videos are TikTok videos, you know, right now. And people make those for like $0. So it's like, which I love. I think that's fantastic. But yeah, we got caught up in that industry where there would be a budget at Geffen Records for a Sonic Youth video. And you would like negotiate that budget, but it would be like, you know, like $80,000 or something like that. It's like, really? How about if we make it for $8,000 and can we pocket the rest of that money? He's like, no, it doesn't work that way.
You have a recent musical discovery that you'd like to share with our listeners. It doesn't necessarily have to be a new band or a new artist, but something that has been new to your ears recently.
Well, I'm going to be a little self-serving, you know, allow me to be that, because I've been going to a lot of shows with this new group led by this young woman named Devin Ross. And Eva and I have a record label called Daydream Library Series, and we put out different records. We put a couple of great records by Big Joni, this band from London, and a few other things. And one of the most recent records we put out is called Oxford Gardens by this young woman named Devin Ross. And she has this really great group, and we've been sort of working with her. And, you know, people send me music all the time, and I never really respond, or it doesn't really resonate with me enough where I wouldn't want to put it out. You know, I was talking to Ian Mackay at Fugazi, Minor Threat, and he runs Discord Records. He says, you know, his whole thing was like, if you don't love a band or an artist, don't put their record out. And he's right about that. And I always felt, you know, you mentioned at one point that I had put out so many records on Ecstatic Peace, and I did, but a lot of them were just sort of cassettes, and you know, like they're editions of 50 or something like that. So it does add up. But I loved every single one of them. You know, they're all a lot of underground weird noise stuff. Devin Ross is definitely a songwriter, and she comes out of the whole sort of Nirvana Sonic Youth world. But she's very young. She's in her early 20s. And I met her because she was acting in a TV series on HBO called Irma Vep. And I was asked to do music for that. Mm. And it was directed by Olivier Assayas, this French film director that Sonic Youth has some connection with. And so I met her and she said, can I send you some music? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? You know, people ask me all the time. And she sent it and I listened to it. And I thought it was really good. And so we put it out as a four song, a 12-inch EP. And she put this band together, you know, it's her and, this young man, Marlon Sexton. He's the son of Charlie Sexton, the guitar player from Elvis band in his own world out of Austin, Texas. And she's the daughter of Craig Ross, who's the guitar player in Lenny Kravitz's band. So they're children of musicians who came up in families where, you know, music was central to their lives. And so in some ways that doesn't really matter to me at all, but I can really sort of hear how important it is to them, as young people making music. They really sort of, came up and learned songcraft from like really great songwriters. And so she's writing these really incredible songs. And so I just spent the last week, touring with this band, you know, as the label manager grandpa, you know, making sure they get to the shows that were happening at all the Rough Trade record stores in England, you know, right. We would play in front of like a handful of people so they could sort of see and hear this band. And so that's what I've been listening to. And to me, it is a discovery because there's a lot of bands that sort of play in that kind of that style and that sort of, you know, that love of that kind of genre of music. But it needs to have a certain je ne sais quoi, a certain magic element, a certain really personal, like kind of new vibe to it that makes the music sort of stand apart and be distinct. And I realize that this band does. I even tell it to them. I kind of embarrass them. I was like, you know, you guys are really good at what you're doing. And I don't do that just to like, you know, float their boat. I was like, I really feel that way. It's the same thing I feel when I see really good bands. It's when I see, you know, when I would see Nirvana at their best or would see Mudhoney at their best, or I, you know, it's like, this is really good, you know? And so that's right now asking me right now, that is sort of what, you know, has gotten, I love having that feeling, you know, when you're sort of like, you know, working with musicians and it's like, oh my God, it's like, this is why I've always loved this for the last 66 years.
Well, when you get excited, when you actually connect with something, it makes you feel something.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. It's on the cellular level. That's why you and I look like we're like just in our 30s.
Exactly. You know, it's funny because, you know, people send me music all the time as well, as you can imagine. And I don't know if you have this same feeling. Whenever somebody hands me something or sends me something, especially if it's somebody, it's a friend of a friend or whatever, I want to love it.
Yeah.
I really do. I want to love it. And it's so rare that you actually do. And that's no diss on anybody who's making music, because I think anybody who writes and records a song and puts it out, straight away, you have my respect, but I'm not going to like everything, and neither are you. So when you actually do, it means something, and you evangelize about it, which you just did right now on the podcast.
Very true. I mean, yeah. I mean, I get inundated, you know, with files and physical media, and I do, and I if I know who it is, yeah, I'll give it a snort, but you know. Yeah, it's usually not something that I want to invest any more of my energy to. I mean, I respect it entirely, you know. So this was one of the few times where it kind of lit my fuse. And so, yeah, I'm just like, really excited by this songwriter, and hopefully she'll continue. I don't see why she wouldn't. You know, she's fully, it has her world. She grew up in it. And I kind of relate to it because, yeah, I guess when you're sort of born into a family where it's just like, that's your world, you know, it's like, you feel like you're just defined by everything else is just sort of like secondary and tertiary to of just being engulfed in wanting to be in the music world. You know,
I was thinking that when you were sharing that she who's the other guy in the band?
Marlon Sexton.
When you said that they grew up around it, and I was thinking, well, kind of like you, you were telling me earlier on in the conversation about how you went to somebody else's house and they didn't have a grand piano, and you're like, what's wrong here? If you're surrounded by something, it's inevitable that you will perhaps be drawn into that world in some way or another. I mean, some people reject it, but they usually sort of come back around.
Some do. I mean, some people grew up in really sort of, you know, famous music families, and they do not, it's just not part of their desire. I mean, it does happen, but I think most people are, I mean, it's like Sean Lennon, you know, he's just like, he's such an incredible, incredible musician, you know, but yeah, sure. He's John Lennon, Yoko Ono's son, but it's not like he had any decision. It was just like, it was just there for him, you know, and he just like feels it. It's not like he can really just sort of walk away from it. It's like sort of walking away from your own kind of human condition, something like that. So in some ways it's not a decision. It's just, it's really part of your DNA.
Is there a band or an artist that you love, but you feel perhaps they never quite got the break that they should have?
Well, it matters what that break is. I mean, we came from a culture where success was just sort of like selling a few thousand records and being, you know, part of being kind of embraced by your scene and, you know, and being able to sort of do a little better than breaking even on tour or something like that. So, you know, there was a lot of sort of, there's a lot of pushback against sort of what success meant in the quote unquote straight world. That's how we sort of came up. So once things from our culture would have some modicum of like commercial success, it was a little bit usually predicated upon that music being kind of corny or whatever, you know? And so, it really wasn't until the explosion of Nirvana where it was like, well, there's no aspect of them kind of, you know, kowtowing or pandering to the mainstream. It's just like, they are accepted in the mainstream. And that changed everything, you know, big time. It was just like, it changed everything. And so it was sort of like, it was all of a sudden the idea that it wasn't cool to sort of like, you know, have any relationship to the mainstream was just out the window at that point. But they're all through the late 70s and through the 80s. It's like, that was always considered, you know, the wrong route. You know, Black Flag had a song like, you know, the mainstream was the lame stream, you know, it was like, that was our thing. Anyway, I mean, for me, the bands that, there were so many bands that were, that I feel were just completely magnificent that didn't get much recognition, hundreds of them. I was thinking when looking at that question though, it was like, you know, there were some bands on the CBGB scene and Max's Kansas City scene in the heyday of the 76, 77, 78 era that you would see that were really kind of great that I felt like should have been getting as much attention as Talking Heads and Blondie, that kind of big break that those bands got, you know. And it was a band called Nervous Rex.
Mm.
Remember them? It's spelled Nervus Rex, Nervous Rex, kind of a play on words, obviously. And I was interested in that band because the bass player was this young woman named Trixie A. Balm, B-A-L-M. And she was a rock writer. I would see her byline in different places, New York Rocker, Rolling Stone or whatever. It was at a time when you would see rock writing and weird magazines like National Lampoon or like men's magazines and, you know, Playboy and what have you. And there would be reportage on what was going on in the underground music scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But she was one of those writers around that time, at the same time that Lester Bangs and Richard Meltzer and Patti Smith were all sort of like filing copy. Trixie Abom was as well. And so I was really interested in rock writers who were in rock bands, you know. I mean, that's what generally made me want to hear Patti Smith's first single, was that a rock writer made a record. You know, she did a cover of Hey Joe.
Yeah, you knew her as a writer first.
Yeah, yeah. So you wanted to, like, oh, what is it? That was, I totally remember, like, wanting to hear that record because I wanted to hear what this writer sounded like on a record.
Yeah.
You know, and because that was unusual, really unusual. And she kind of super pulled it off in a way where it's like, well, she's something else. But so anyway, I was attracted to Nervous Rex because I was attracted to Trixie Abom. I had a bit of a crush on this woman.
Now it's coming out.
Yeah, completely. I mean, my love for most bands is because, you know, is there's always something very sort of alluring going on with, like, the with somebody in the band. And so this was and that was so great about punk was just like, there was like so many like incredible women on the scene that it was not even like considered to be like a, like in most industries, like, you know, women were coming from the left of the dial. It was just like, no, it was like the strength of the scene was that it was actually predominantly female energy going on there, you know? So the leaders of the scene were not Johnny Rotten and Johnny Ramone. It was like Patti Smith and you know, and Susie Sue and Debbie Harry. And I mean, it's like, so it was that gender balance was like really, 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 really important and significant for young men like me in the, you know, in the part time period of our lives. You know, it was really, it was very feminist and radically so. And so, that said, Nervous Rex to me were a band that played really sharp pop rock new wave songs. And they did covers of really great kind of 60s tunes, like the Hollies, you know, they would do Hollies covers and stuff. And they were just really good. And I forgot who the singer-songwriter guy was in the band. And he just really had a lot of, you know, he had a really just great sense of just like pop dynamics, you know, in a new wave way. And, you know, I just thought they were a really good band more. And it was a lot more than just my, you know, my attraction to Trixie Abom, but she, you know, that added to it, but she was a really great bass player. He was a great guitar player, singer. And I forget who the other guys were.
Right.
I think it was all other guys. They were really good. And I would see them a lot. They were like there was a few perennial like kind of bands that were always playing those clubs that were kind of like always, you know, the first or second on before like the main act kind of thing. You know, there was them, there was a band called Spicy Bits who were kind of good. But Nervous Rex were good. They made an album. It didn't really do anything. Nobody talked about it. I don't think the album really captured them. And what I had heard, the thrill I got from hearing them, I don't think it was ever captured on that album. I haven't returned to it in a few decades, but you know, maybe I'm wrong about that. They were a band that didn't get a big break.
It's interesting when you look back at that time, though, because there were a ton of bands who were just so visceral in the live performance, but could never quite get that on tape.
No, not at all. There was a band at CBGB's that everybody loved that played a lot called, they are from New Jersey, and they were called Steel Tips. And they were incredible. You know, they would come out, they had really good songs, this really interesting guitar player, and the two lead singers, and one lead singer was this really heavy set, grubby looking guy who dressed up as if he was like the local garbage man, you know, coming down the street, like jumping off the back and picking up garbage cans and dumping them. That was his look, greased back hair, you know, his big tummy poking out of from his grimy t-shirt. And the other lead singer was like a young girl dressed up in like a Catholic schoolgirl's outfit. And they traded vocals back and forth. And they were, you know, and then they had this other guy who blew himself up on stage wrapping fireworks around his body.
Wow.
He was a famous performance artist, I forget his name. And yeah, Steel Tips, man. I mean, you know, that was a good night out seeing Steel Tips. They never got a big break. And they had good songs too. Yeah.
We're down to our last two questions. And the next one is kind of interesting when I'm thinking now about the range of music that we've discussed over this conversation, because we started off by talking about I Am Butterfly. And then you're talking about Devin Ross. And in between those artists, you must have heard so much music. And I'm wondering if at all you picked up a musical guilty pleasure along the way.
Well, I would say certainly 70s AM hits, you know, all of the Ride Captain Ride, you know, all these kind of like one hit wonder bands, you know, Sean, Na 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 Na, Kiss 'Em Goodbye by Steam, you know, these bands that sort of had one song that was just kind of a radio staple for one of those years in the late 60s, early 70s. I love those songs and I love those kind of bands, you know, that's, you know, that existed just to play those songs. So I love that. That's a guilty pleasure. AM staples from like the early 70s. It's like, I love that. I love those songs. In fact, I find those are songs that to me have been really instrumental in my own sort of song craft inspiration. You know, I mean, I those songs really intrigue and inspire me to like, to want to write songs and put them into the context of other things and other ideas, you know.
Have you always been aware of that, or is that a realization that's come to you later on?
No, I loved all those songs when they were happening.
Right.
You know, listening to my transistor radio or whatever coming out of the AM car radio station. And then when it became a bit of a golden oldies thing later on, it was fortuitous, because then you would have radio stations that were just sort of, that's all they would play. Like going back to like, no, hey, we're just going to play 70s AM gold. And I was like, yeah.
You're reminding me of when I was in radio up in Woodstock, when I got going on this career, and I would do fill-ins. You know, when you start off, you just sort of do a fill-in on whatever show you can get a gig on. So I covered every shift imaginable through the years, you know, from jazz to new age to oldies. And the thing about being a DJ when you're playing oldies is they're all like 2.5 minutes long.
Exactly.
It's the busiest hours I've ever spent on the radio, because as soon as I put the song on, it's time for another one.
Exactly. I like playing those songs as a DJ. There's a noise artist, a very infamous noise artist in Miami, Florida, named Rat Bastard. He's a bit of a legend in the noise underground. But he also DJs. And when he DJs, we're the same age. He's born in 58. When he DJs, all he does is play like early 70s AM 7 inches. You know, that's what he plays.
And he's busy. Like, yeah.
Oh my God, it's so good. He's like, it's in some ways that's our avant-garde.
So as we wrap this up, first of all, thank you. It's great to see you. I think it's just about 1 o'clock in the afternoon here in Los Angeles, which means it's about 9 o'clock where you are in London. I can see a window behind you, and I can see the light has started to sort of get darker as we've been talking. So as we wrap up our conversation today, my final question is, how are you feeling right now?
Physically or emotionally?
Either or both.
I feel great. I mean, you know, I've had some health issues the last couple of years that I've been sort of dealing with, and it's kept me from doing what I usually do, which is sort of like getting in a van and playing every beer hall, you know, around the globe, which I don't mind doing. I've been doing it forever on different levels, but you know, in some ways I'm also sort of I'm feeling good because I feel like I'm doing what I really been wanting to do since I got into my 60s, which is to sort of stay in one place more often than not and focus on writing. And so I've been writing a book of fiction that takes place in early 80s New York City. Mm. And that's what I've been doing. And as well as, you know, talking to you and others about this new record I have coming out. But I won't be touring so much for it. I'll probably do a few things, a few shows, a few here and there. But I'm kind of more than happy to not do that so much. And I'm feeling good about that. Health-wise, I'm okay. I just have to take care of a few things. You know, there's nothing dastardly really going on. Emotionally, no, I'm great. You know, Eva and I live together in our home, and we have two dogs that we, you know, that are fantastic. That keeps us very busy, and we both keep very busy. I mean, she's a book editor and puts me to shame when it comes to, like, you know, a workload. So I'm kind of like strategizing how to retire with some kind of dignity, you know, but I,
me too. I can't figure it out though.
I can't figure it out. It's just, you know, I guess, you know, you think about like music and art and what we're involved with. It's like, I don't think there's not a shelf life there, is there? You know?
No, I mean, as long as you can keep all the plates spinning and pay the bills, then, you know, I think that's an achievement in itself. But it's been great hanging out with you over the Zoom, and thanks for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, Nick. Yeah, I mean, anytime, you know where to find me.
The Sound of Success is hosted and produced by me, Nick Harcourt, for Nude and Ginger Productions. Our theme music is by Keita Klein. For more episodes, find us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, and thanks for listening.